Your energy is gone, your hunger is loud, and your plans aren't feeding you. So what are you still doing here? Get your afternoon pick-me-up with a refreshing large Big Gulp drink at 7-Eleven. Cold, refreshing, and made the way you like it. It's available at 7-Eleven and just 59 cents with 7 rewards. Visit your local Columbus 7-Eleven and satisfy that craving today. Valid through 6/23/26. While supplies last, participating stores see app for full terms.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. It is Monday, so we're here with Editor-at-Large Bill Kristol. And, last week was pretty heavy. It's pretty heavy. A lot of serious topics, a lot of serious guests. We appreciated all of them. And so I have saved a section at the end of the podcast for some laughs. I feel like we need some laughter and deserve some laughter, Bill. And so, we'll kind of see. Do you have a favorite stand-up comedian? Is there an old-timer that you're into?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I'll think about it and get back to you at the end of the show.
Okay.
I can tell some of my favorite Henny Youngman jokes. That'll go over well. That'll date me back to 1946 or something like that.
That's exactly what I was hoping for in the answer. So you work on that. We need to start, though, with serious matters abroad and domestically. And I want to really begin with our friend and colleague, well, not really colleague, but your former colleague, my aspiring colleague, Bob Kagan, who is in The Atlantic yesterday with an article titled Checkmate in Iran, Washington Can't Reverse or Control the Consequences of Losing This War. And it's really well argued and just basically a full accounting of how rough the situation is strategically and geopolitically right now for Trump. And he goes into a lot of themes that he went into a month ago when he was on this podcast, because not a lot has changed since then. But I do think he kind of even broadens it out further as far as why this is such a geopolitical strategic defeat, even more so than whatever Vietnam, et cetera, because of what some of the implications are for us losing control of the Strait of Hormuz. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on his assessment.
Yeah, no, I think it's a very strong piece, and he's been arguing this for a while, as you say, but I think he's being vindicated by events. Trump understandably does not want to escalate. He doesn't want to get in an even bigger war. And I think the conventional wisdom has been, well, it's not great for Trump, but he kind of, and I've had this view somewhat, and he can slide out of it without too much damage to himself, or I suppose to the U.S. Iran's capabilities have been degraded. We've paid a price. The world economy has paid a price, but we can recover. I still think it'd be a pretty serious defeat. Bob is more struck by the severity of that defeat, also struck by the fact that Iran, he's been right about this for the last week or so, we've been talking about it on the phone a lot, Iran's not so eager to let Trump slither away, right? I mean, that's really striking. And Iran feels they have the upper hand. I kind of thought maybe they're just a little worried about being pummeled again, and they just end it in a good situation, pocket their winnings, and in a pretty good situation for them. But so far, they haven't seemed to want to do that. And Trump has, bellowed and threatened, but not done much. So we'll see what happens. Meanwhile, the strait is closed and the economy, the global economy pays more of a price. But I think what Bob's big contribution is seeing that what a defeat it is for us to allow Iran to have allowed Iran to establish the principle that they can close the strait. And that's established going forward. Whatever fake kind of agreement there is, Iran says, well, we'll open it. They're pretty much making clear that it's at their sufferance. 40 years. Trump likes to talk about 47 years this nation's been plaguing the world. It has been plaguing the world and us and others for 47 years and is a very bad regime. The one thing they've never done in the last 40 years, been intimidated from doing, was closing the strait, really.
Yeah.
Kind of striking, isn't it? All these wars going on in the region, including with Iran. And, we hit Iran in 2020. And then again in June, Israel and the U.S. hit Iran. They didn't close the strait. That principle, they didn't want to challenge the principle that we upheld with many others of, freedom of passage in international waters. And now they've established the principle that they can do this. That's a huge defeat. And then the damage that's been done to our alliances in Europe and elsewhere, confidence in us by the Asians who depend much more on the Strait, you know, for oil and for energy. The Gulf states now signaling, who were hawkish near the beginning. They thought Trump might go in and take care of Iran, which not a nation, not a regime they like,
yeah,
get along with very well and are scared by. Now they seem to be telling Trump, could you end this, please? This is just getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, so they are going to make their own deals with Iran and also their own deals with countries like China, which seem like maybe more reliable allies than us. So I think Bob has seen the big picture of the damage to the U.S. standing in the world.
And I think that those are the two things that struck me, just like the Arab states maybe feeling like they need to make deals with Iran now, which is just a dramatic change from just a couple months ago, just for economic purposes. And then just as general principle, you know, it's kind of a piece of a lot of from the Trump era. There were these like kind of general principles that just were things that existed since I was born that like you didn't really have to think about, right? The president leaves when an election is over, you know, that president follows a Supreme Court ruling, right? You know, that we are going to maybe have disagreements, but like generally, you know, work in concert with our allies and the democratic nations of Europe and abroad, right? Like there are just all these general principles that Trump has upended. And this one of like freedom of navigation on the seas is something that just has been the norm in the post-World War II era. And the U.S. through, you know, sometimes through military power, but also just like projection of strength and, you know, fear from other countries of wanting to incur the wrath of the U.S. You know, we've had like these freedom of the seas for commercial ships to travel globally. And like that is now in question. And if you listen to Trump in his interviews, he doesn't seem to really prioritize or care about returning to that. And you hear him say a lot like, well, we've got a lot of ports. You know, we got ports in Alaska and Texas and people are getting our oil from us now. I don't know. Like in some ways, you know, he like Bibi was on 60 Minutes talking about how he talked to Trump about how Trump wants to send in troops to go get the nuclear stuff. Who knows if that's true or not? That's what Bibi says. And so you have that like kind of pushing for more aggressive action. But on the other hand, you have Trump like not seeming to really care that much that the Strait of, again, maybe it's bluster, but like, and if he decides that it doesn't really matter because we have our own ports and our own oil exports. And, you know, if Iran decides to put a toll on the Strait, like that's a problem for Asia, but not a problem for us. If like that's what he decides, like that's a major shift in kind of how the world has worked and one that decreases our power.
Yeah, I mean, it's America first and taken to its reasonable conclusion, not reasonable, but logical conclusion, I guess. Yeah, which is who needs all this upholding the international order and providing a public good of free transit of the seas and holding open straits that are thousands of miles away from us and so forth. Let others do it. We've got our ports. Maybe we'll take care of our immediate vicinity. And that's actually in their strategy document. Western Hemisphere comes first. I mean, the price we will pay for letting the whole rest of the world outside the Western Hemisphere, maybe somewhat in the Western Hemisphere too, but certainly outside the Western Hemisphere, kind of just topple into or descend into, you know, man eats dog, everyone, or dog eats man, whatever, which is that man eats dog, I can't remember anymore. everyone for himself, you know, countries just making their own arrangements. It can be sort of stable for a while because countries will watch out for themselves and they'll act in their self-interest. But that's what kind of got us into two world wars. It's not a recipe. Eventually it'll come back to bite us. I mean, it did in 1914, it did in 1939. And it's certainly going to do huge damage to all, as you say, a lot of things we just taken for granted, this global trade and commerce, everything that we just sort of assume happens, and then it gets interrupted by the pandemic, and that was terrible, but then it got back on course again. And, you know, we can quibble about, argue about, well, should China be permitted to have these particular chips and all that? That's a national security question. Fine. But in general, the principle that we can, all these goods will flow. And I mean, that ends. Nations can't depend on us. They look to their own weapons. They suddenly decide they have to arm themselves. You just get regional conflicts all over the place, regional accommodations to all over the place to various dictators. No, it is the end. I mean, it's what a lot of people have been writing about, we've been talking about, and it's been sort of on clearly beginning to happen for the last year and a half, the end of the post-World War II order. But this war in Iran really has, I think, don't you think, been the exclamation point on that, on the end of that
Yeah, accelerant was the word I was going to use, but yeah, same thing. Yeah, same trajectory. So just to that point, and the latest on talks is the same as it's been, but should mention that over the weekend, the Iran foreign ministry responded to a U.S. proposal to end the war, and their response included sovereignty over the state. Sovereignty. People get mad at me. Whatever. Over the Strait of Hormuz and a bunch of other stuff that Trump responded and said was not reasonable. So that's where we're at. We're at the same as it ever was.
But you're right. One thing Trump seems to stress over and over is the nuclear material. It's a little weird. I mean, honestly, this stuff is not usable right now. It seems to be buried away. If they try to start getting at it, we will see it and can act to stop them, I should think. I'm not against getting the stuff out of there, but the idea that we fought this whole war because of stuff that we pulverized, obliterated in, was that June of last summer?
Not sure.
It's just ridiculous. But it is very revealing. I think he says just because that's very important to Israel, honestly, and for Bibi, really stopping the nuclear program and not even giving them any remnant of one is so important. It's not consistent with America First.
No.
That nuclear dust, as Trump calls it, poses zero threat to the United States of America right now or for the foreseeable future. But it poses a threat to Israel, which is, you know, a real thing. We should work. In the old days, we worried about that because we worried about threats to other nations around the world and destabilizing influences and so forth. Sort of left over in this case because of Trump's being close to Netanyahu, I suppose. But so he keeps repeating that. He never explains why that's so important. But it is very striking how he, after a week or so where opening the Strait of Hormuz was important to us, that we closed it. So we, I guess, for the sake of opening it. Now that seems to just recede. We have this blockade there. What's the point of it? I mean, to tighten the screws on Iran, I guess, so they'll then be more reasonable on the nuclear thing. It's an awfully...
To me, it just feels like a tangible... And Israel's part of it for sure, but it also just feels like a tangible thing Trump can wrap his head around. That's like, this is something that we did. Like he wants, as we'll get to, a trophy, a statue. Right. Like he wants something. Right now, like the argument is weak. It's like he can sense it. You know, like he tries to say it, like they've been obliterated. And it's like, okay, so they've lost their ships. But like the nuclear, that's the thing for him to say. Like we got the nuclear.
That's a good point.
I do think that there's a simplicity and talking point element to it. This is kind of related to all this, but it struck me. Trump did an interview with Cheryl Atkinson, who is a little kooky these days, who's got her own YouTube channel. Nothing wrong with doing news on the YouTube. I'm doing that. Subscribe to the Bulwark YouTube if you haven't already. But she's got a pretty kooky channel. Trump did that. And he said this about the Strait. NATO has proven to be a paper tiger. We don't use the Strait. We don't need it. We don't need the Strait. We were doing it to help Israel and Saudi Arabia. We don't need it. We don't use it. I like, there's just so much revealing about that there, right? Like that, A, we were doing this to help Israel and Saudi Arabia. Like he just comes out and says it again, contra America First, but also just like the degree to which like NATO had nothing to do with this. We didn't call NATO. We didn't get NATO involved. No. Like this was not a defense issue. It has nothing to do with the NATO treaty, but he is like looking for any excuse to kind of blame NATO and more kind of formally separate from those countries because he doesn't like them personally and because he feels like they're mean to him, et cetera, et cetera.
And he wants to blow up to the degree he has any view beyond the personal, it's that he wants to blow up the post-World War II order, which he vaguely thinks has been bad for the U.S., though it's been very good for the U.S., and NATO is a key part of that. Yeah, I mean, the normal, incidentally, person who knows a little bit about international trade, you say, who benefits a lot from the Strait? People would say Asia and Japan and South Korea, two kind of important allies of ours. He has no thought about them. Bob made the point to me, I don't think he shows us this in the piece. The Japanese prime minister had... She went pretty far in trying to really accommodate Trump and get along with him. She came here, swallowed hard when Trump made his Pearl Harbor joke. Remember that? And she was in the Oval Office. That was shortly after the war began, I think. And she, you know, she got a lot of grief back at home, apparently, for not speaking up a little more on that. But whatever, she felt it was important. Trump couldn't care less about that. Why do we have the troops in Japan from Trump's point of view, incidentally? I mean, and therefore... Japan starts thinking, hey, we've got to take care of ourselves. South Korea starts thinking that. Suddenly Asia, which has been very stable for a long time, and that's been pretty good for the world, you know, that starts to fall apart. I mean, the key thing I just want to worry about Bob's piece, he uses the word defeat. And I think he does that on purpose to kind of really try to bring home to people, this is a real defeat. It's not, didn't quite work out as well as we hoped, or didn't quite get all the things we wanted, or kind of a stumble. It's an important defeat for the United States.
When she was there, the prime minister was visiting, I remember he makes this joke about how, you know, that we weren't warned about Pearl Harbor, and she's complaining that like Japan wasn't consulted. And we were saying at the time, it was like, how did Pearl Harbor work out for the Japanese? Like, not great in the end. Ended up weakening them quite a bit. And really, there are a lot more parallels than maybe he realized between our action in Iran and Pearl Harbor. Delete Me makes it easy, quick, and safe to remove your personal data online at a time when surveillance and data breaches are common enough to make everyone vulnerable. Delete Me does all the hard work of wiping your personal information from data broker websites. It's easy. All you have to do is sign up and let Delete Me know exactly what information you want deleted. And their experts take it from there. As somebody that has an active online presence, to say the least, I made a mistake this weekend, I think. I started engaging with random Louisiana influencer accounts. You know, because I'm just so fucking pissed about the VRA thing. And so then I'm getting more and more random people who are like local political influencers in my feed and MAGA ones. And so I started replying to them. And my husband is like, is this creating a greater likelihood that we have a confrontation at Lafitte's blacksmith shop? And I was like, maybe slightly. So maybe I should stop doing that. But point is, I'm online a lot. So, you know, you want to have the protections, the basic protections that you can have within the context of my behavior. And Delete Me helps me do that. They send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. It gives me and the family a little peace of mind to know that it's constantly monitoring and removing the personal information that we don't want on the internet. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/bulwark and use promo code bulwark at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/bulwark and enter code bulwark at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/bulwark, code bulwark. On the NATO point, you had Phillips O'Brien on your conversation with Bill Kristol. There is some pretty interesting developments happening in the Russia-Ukraine war. Putin started sounding a little bit of a different note in his, I hate to even call it a press conference, whatever you want to call it, you know, with this kind of kayfabe gatherings that he has to make pronouncements with state media in front of him. But he started talking about how maybe the war could be ending soon. Zelensky wants to come to Moscow. He's doing kind of the Putin thing where he was, you know, speaking in code a little bit and trolling a little bit, but also definitely like it was different than in the past, kind of like his bravado of how Russia was on the march, etc. So he starts opening the door to maybe finding an off ramp. And this is happening, I don't think coincidentally, simultaneously with Ukraine, like gaining a lot of military ground for the first time in a while, and the front lines have been pretty stagnant thanks to drone warfare. So anyway, you had a long conversation with Phillips about this. I'm wondering what your takeaways were.
Yeah, I mean, Phil really is a military historian, so he really knows the military stuff. And very early on, he thought Ukraine would hold. And he's always been more bullish on Ukraine than the conventional wisdom, and was right for the first 2 years, 3 years, frustrated that the U.S. didn't do more and Europe could have done more. But he was basically right that Russia would not walk right over them. He was right that, unlike Trump, who believed they would, and that Trump, Russia holds all the cards, and that then Trump holds all the cards. Now, Phil and everyone else is very worried, obviously, a year ago when we cut off our aid, which was kind of important. But it turns out Ukraine's progress in the drone side of things and the progress of drones as a military weapon and the transformation of the battlefield that they have caused is pretty astounding. And he says really a kind of, he doesn't like to use the term revolution in military warfare, but, you know, a real transformation. And so that's enabled them to stabilize the battlefield and maybe have a bit of an advantage now. And also the Russian casualties. Kathy Young has a good piece on the website, on the Bulwark website, about this kind of sad Victory Day parade Putin had where they cut it back. First, he went to Trump to get Zelensky to promise not to attack it with drones. Actually, Zelensky did, but he sort of trolled Putin by kind of embarrassing him. And also the other point he made that I hadn't really thought as much about is we're all happy Orban lost. But one real practical effect of Orban losing is that he had been blocking the $90 billion of aid from the EU to Ukraine, which probably is enough for them for the next year. So they can keep on, not just keep on fighting, but take the fight to the Russians. So that looks much more promising. Ironically, I mean, in a weird way, Trump's forced the Europeans to step up, and they are doing so much more. Mostly it's Russia that's forced the Ukrainians to defend on themselves and have this fantastic ability to make the drones. But still, Trump's accelerated that probably. So yeah, that war looks like it's going better. I think Putin's sort of throwing something out here on the, well, it could end if only Zelensky comes to Moscow, we'll negotiate something. But of course, Putin's terms are not going to be acceptable to Zelensky. Putin wants to keep probably 20% of Ukraine that they have, and that's not going to happen. Right. So I'm dubious that there'll be an agreement. There might be a bit of, you could imagine some ceasefires though, and that kind of thing maybe. What Phil is most worried about is Putin and Trump actually getting together, maybe with Chinese sort of backing to really kind of agree to actually, you know, make things tougher on Ukraine. Trump has been out of the war. He hasn't really been an aggressive adversary of Zelensky at this point, but it could get a little worse.
I mean, the counter to that is that's been disastrous in Iran, this kind of shift within the Trump administration, but maybe, you know, points to a little less worry on that front, that he's going to align so much with Russia, is that like the people with his ear right now, at least, are the relatively more pro-Ukraine, not as pro-Ukraine as we would like, but the relatively more hostile to Russia elements of his administration, be that Marco or the people outside the administration he's talking to, Thiessen and Levin, et cetera. Like, you know, the war in Iran has been kind of more what that crowd wants and less what the J.D. Vances of the world want. So we'll see how that plays out, but it's an interesting development. And the other potential is, which kind of ties to what you're saying at the top, is Trump just deciding to wash his hands of this altogether. You know, it is the inevitable destination of America first. Like, I don't care about this at all. The Europeans can hash this out. The Arab nations, states can hash this out. And I'm going to pivot back to the Western Hemisphere and focus on toppling Cuba. And we have a couple pieces of evidence of that. Many more surveillance flights over Cuba than previously. There was reporting on that over the weekend, and that is in line with kind of what they were seeing before we went into Venezuela and Iran. Trump expressed in that same YouTube interview a frustration that the Cuban regime hasn't already been toppled by the economic pressure we've been putting on Cuba. And he's, you know, basically saying, once we deal with this one, we're on to the next, something to that effect about pushing towards Cuba. So that seems inevitable at this point.
I guess so. I mean, A.B. Stoddard, our former colleague, said in a conversation about 3 weeks ago or so, I said, this could lead, you know, Iran could lead him to sort of say, ugh, maybe I should avoid all these foreign adventures and, you know, get back to demagoguing on domestic issues and I'll have better luck with that. But she said, no, the psychology is he needs a big win. And Cuba's the easiest one, and he's got some support for it here because Cuba is a terrible regime and we've been so at odds with it for so many decades. Yeah, I really wonder whether he's thinking, you know, August, September, before the midterms, maybe not even that far off, you know, June, July, time for the invasion of Cuba or just the pressure, kind of a Venezuela type situation. I don't know. But apart from the bad ideological elements of the Trump administration, it's driven so much now by his megalomania and vanity and all that. It really is dangerous. A lot of it could peter out into silly things. You know, I hate all the triumphal arch and the statue and all that stuff. But in a way, you've made this point before, you know, maybe it's better if he just distracts himself with all that, you know, and doesn't go around causing huge foreign policy crises, which do real damage to us and the world. But unfortunately, it's of a piece, you know, and I suspect we're going to see something with Cuba. Yeah.
Summer is right around the corner and I love the heat. So that just means I get outside more and more. We moved here to Louisiana. We moved in the summer and immediately everybody was like, I'm so sorry for this weather. And I was like, this is why I'm here. I want to leave in the winter to go to other warm places. It's that Lebanese skin. But, you know, when you're outside, when you're seeing concerts, you're just going to a crawfish boil, you need good outdoor clothes. You need something comfy and cute. And thanks to Mack Weldon, I got the wardrobe staples I need to be ready for anything. You can discover upgraded basics, fresh styles, and more at MackWeldon.com. Plus, get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with code THEBULWARK. I got a few Mack Weldon pieces I really like. You've probably seen, I got these little short sleeve button downs that I'm doing now. A lot of short sleeve button downs. For the pod, it's just the button down and the necklace. Sometimes when I'm out there, you know, among the people, put on a little tank top underneath, have the short sleeve button down open, a little more of a casual look. Mack Weldon's got a bunch of different options to choose from, and I've been digging them. I've also been looking at the Ace collection. They've got some Ace sweat shorts that are cozy for sitting around the house. That's good for podcasting too. You know, it's like business on top, party on the bottom. So the Ace collection something I think you should look into as well. Add comfort and flair to your closet this year with the Ace Line. It's the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Get moving with Mack Weldon, comfortable anywhere. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code TheBulwark. That's MackWeldon.com, code TheBulwark. I want to move forward to the domestic stuff. Obviously, there's a bunch of panic and rage and anger in Democratic circles over the redistricting ruling. We were discussing, this was kind of happening as we were taping on Friday with Adam Serwer. The Virginia ruling comes down that negates the will of you and your fellow Virginians who voted in a ballot initiative to redraw the maps. The courts overturned that. So we have a couple of things like happening simultaneously. There is, I just think, complete righteous anger about what is happening in the South and how the Republicans are going to try to redraw out all of the districts that are represented by blacks in the old Confederacy. And then you also have, I think, a real, I don't know if panic is the right word, but concern among Democrats about, okay, is there any way to mitigate this right now? Because I think that the House of Representatives still looks quite likely to flip to the Democrats, but it's a much closer run call now with the way that the Republicans have successfully rigged the map in some of these states. So a bunch there. I was wondering what your initial reactions are. We'll go through a couple of the elements.
I'd say they threw out a referendum and a pretty shaky technical alleged problem with the way the state legislature did it. And 4-3 decision, I think the dissent's stronger than the majority opinion, but it's not, no way to really overturn it, I wouldn't say. I think that would have moved from a 6-5 Democratic apportionment to 10-1, probably. I think in any kind of decent Democratic year, that 6-5 goes, the current 6-5 goes 7-4, maybe 8-3. A couple of those districts are pretty close.
Yeah, I think 8-3.
You know, yeah. You know, so it's a 2-seat loss. That's a Democratic redistricting thrown out by the court. So we have a weird way of appointing judges here in Virginia, the Supreme Court judges. So I don't think, to be fair, it's not clear that's racially driven. I mean, it's more partisan. The racial stuff in the South is pretty...
It is truly insane, though, just really quick. Like, it's pretty rare that a court overturns an election result.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there aren't a ton of examples of that. And do so on 4-3 grounds.
Highly litigated one. Yeah, I know. It's a little unusual, very unusual. And turns around what people were planning on in terms of the districts they were going to run on, the primaries in August. The Southern stuff is pretty grotesque. I mean, I really feel, I just can't quite believe, to see it happening in 2026, let's just have no blacks in our congressional delegation in these states that have 25% black.
33% black
population. I mean, I don't know. I mean, and also it's so undisguised. I mean, now the partisanship and the racism have a high correlation, as Jaelia Morris pointed out. But of course, one reason the court was able to get to the decision was sort of a fake statistical thing. But it's not really about race; it's about partisanship. But you know what? If one party gets 92% of the white vote, and the other party gets 90% of the black vote, what are you proving when you say it's about party, not about race? I mean, it's ludicrous. It's the same thing. And this is about race, literally. I mean, the decision, the Supreme Court's decision, the U.S. Supreme Court's decision was about race, and gutted Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which had been passed and repassed by Congress by huge majorities. Again, it's a good case, sort of like you're saying about the referendum. This isn't just tweaking with something or an administrative interpretation of the Clean Air Act. This was a major legislation that was passed by Congress.
That's three times.
Yeah, it's three times.
It was reauthorized under Reagan and then reauthorized again under W. Bush.
Right. By big bipartisan majorities. Yeah. And they've been chipping away, well, more than chipping away at it, but undercutting it for quite a while. And this was maybe the final blow. So Sarah and I discussed this some yesterday. I mean, I guess Sarah's very, got to persuade more people and stuff, which is correct, I think. I think also some of the anger can be beneficial in the sense of mobilizing Democratic turnout, including minority turnout in some of these states, which could help with the state with these Senate elections, actually. They can't redistrict the Senate, so can't gerrymander the Senate any more than it is already in terms of rural representation. I remain pretty optimistic. I think it's going to be a very big blue wave, and I think it's probably going to swamp these. The House will be +30 instead of +25 instead of +30, honestly, and And I think the Senate's in play, but maybe I'm kidding myself and I don't blame the pros, the operatives for looking at it and thinking, yikes. Well, final point though, I'd say people are a little too fatalistic about these districts and about the ability of the Republican legislatures to draw them so brilliantly. I saw the Tennessee districts, so they've chopped Memphis up into three pieces, so there's no black, no majority, minority district.
Yeah.
In 2018, when Bredesen ran for Senate, I guess, right, and lost,
yep.
He was a strong Democratic candidate, so that caveat stipulated. He got in the new districts, if you go back and calculate what his vote was, 48 or 49% of the vote, I think, in those three Memphis, partial now Memphis districts.
Yeah.
If 2026 is a good year, Democrats could win one or two of those seats, you know, or maybe three. Yeah. So I think that's true in some of these other states too, I think, that they're not so sure that Democrats can't do okay. But it is certainly it's a hurdle.
And there are two things to look at there. I just on that point about whether the Democrats can win, they can win some of these districts, but it's not as if they'll win so many that it backfires on Republicans. And they can mitigate the Republican gains by winning some of the districts. And that is definitely true.
Right.
Tennessee's going to be very hard, though. The state's moved more to the right since 2018, and Bredesen was a good candidate. And it is just a total outrage. Like you mentioned, like they cut up Memphis into a third, a third, a third. That's, they also cut up the black vote, a third, a third, a third. I mean, it was a purely racial gerrymander in Tennessee to ensure that black voters in Memphis do not have the representation that they choose. Notably in this one case, in all of the other districts, it's a black representative. In this case, it's a white representative, Steve Cohen, though he was in a primary with Justin Pearson. But like, however that like, you know, ends up playing out, right? They divide the city into thirds, which is illegal and an affront and racist and all those things, right? And so, look, I don't want to totally demoralize the people of Tennessee, like, because they simultaneously are living in a basically undemocratic, a state that has like basically done everything possible to minimize their democratic rights. They also have the benefits of having a couple of horrific candidates like Andy Ogles and Scott Desjarlais are like particularly offensive, even within the construct of MAGA, right? Where everybody is offensive, like they stand out as uniquely offensive. So it's possible to go win some of those seats, but it's tough. And Lauren Egan's article, which is well reported at the Wheel of the Bulwark yesterday, it was pretty depressing to me, you know, because it was just like, what is the Democrats' plan? And it's, oh, we've got to run candidates more suited to winning these districts. And like, I agree with that. We do, but it's too late to recruit candidates now. It's in May, and there are a lot of things preventing Democrats from doing that. And you can't overcome this level of cheating solely with persuasion. And persuasion is part of it, but the cheating is pretty effective, at least in the South, for the Republicans. It's spring cleaning time, which is a great time to address some of those household tasks you've been putting off. If you've noticed that you're not sleeping well and it's time for a new mattress, our friends at Helix are here to help. We got a ton of guests in and out around here. I got another one coming this weekend. And there's one thing about having them that's been a little annoying, which is that our Helix mattress is in the guest room. So when we have guests staying, I can't go do my little afternoon Mimi nap in there. And sometimes I'm getting better sleep on that Helix mattress in the guest room, but that's okay. I got a good mattress in my room as well, but we're getting rave reviews for everybody who's coming through for Jazz Fest and elsewhere, and I trust them, so you should too. Helix delivers your mattress right to your door. I had to unpackage it by myself. I'm incompetent. I can't do anything. Can I just say my husband? I forget where my husband was. He was gone. We had a guest coming. I had to unbox it and put it on the bed myself. And I did it. And if I can do it, I promise it's easy and you can do it too. You can do a 120-night sleep trial to make sure you have the right mattress for you. Returns and exchanges are easy. And the Happy with Helix guarantee offers a risk-free customer-first experience. Right now, Helix is having their Memorial Day sale. Go to helixsleep.com/bulwark for 27% off site-wide, exclusive to our listeners. That's helixsleep.com/bulwark for 27% off. helixsleep.com/bulwark. The Virginia thing, I just want to throw this at you. There's a proposal going around in some quarters about changing this rule to lower the mandatory retirement age of Virginia judges to 54, which would essentially fire all the judges on the court. And Suhas Subramaniam, who we had on the podcast, who's a big supporter of the amendment, said this. We have Republican states ignoring their constitutions and interrupting early voting and ignoring their Supreme Courts altogether. We know based on that, Republicans would explore every single option possible to move this forward. So we should do the same. He's pushing for that. I think that that is interesting as a political matter that a quite moderate member of the Virginia congressional delegation is like pushing maximum warfare here. I think that's notable and encouraging. Like this specific tactic, it feels like a bit of a stretch to me even, but I don't know. I mean, I'm curious. I'm intrigued. What's your reaction?
Yeah, I think it's a stretch. And I mean, and what he's responding to is what is happening in the other states, right? He doesn't act. I mean,
right.
Virginia Supreme Court has been pretty bipartisan-ish, that this was a pretty partisan decision, I think. If people ahead of time had said, this is a disaster, it shouldn't go to the court at all, whatever, but, you know, they argued the case. I think they thought they were going to win it, the state. So, no, I don't think that's going to happen. Probably shouldn't happen. I'm certainly for all kinds of hardball. I was for the Virginia redistricting on that grounds, but that was a legal constitutional matter. And precisely, they had to have the referendum because the Virginia Constitution required it. And they also required the two state legislative sessions pass it. And that's why they did the October or November, whatever it was, session, and then the next one. And that's what the little technicality is about. Was that really voters went to the polls in October, not knowing that members had voted or would vote in favor of this thing. It's honestly kind of a ridiculous technicality, I would say. I mean, but anyway, technicality may be giving it a little too much dignity. So no, I'm not with that particular move, but I'm certainly in favor of, I agree with you. You can't wish away the cheat. Look, this is, we have all been saying for a year and a half, some of us have been saying that they're going to do whatever they can. They're going to do whatever they can for 26, they do whatever they can for 28, and whatever they can involves voter suppression. It involves God knows what kinds of shenanigans in terms of the actual voting in September and October, and then in the counting of the ballots. It also involves this kind of thing. So we shouldn't be surprised by it. We should be ready for it, I suppose, as much as we can be. I think going for the intra-Virginia, destroying the Virginia Supreme Court, you know, is a little bit of a weird way to fix this problem, I'd say.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I love the energy, though.
Right. You know?
So keep the energy there. People should be looking to Suhas as kind of a way to have the right
energy. People really need to look at these states and districts. I think Lawrence Peace was excellent. Tennessee may be the worst case, but I don't know, in some of these other states where there could be competitive Senate races, for example, really increased minority turnout could make a difference in a Mississippi or something like that. And so it would be ironic. I've thought about this. Everyone's conventionalism. I always like it when conventionalism could be, you know, is wrong, could be wrong or reversed. Everyone, the absolute conventional wisdom, House, easy, pretty easy for the Dems, Senate, pretty impossible. That was 6 months ago. Then it became House, very easy, Senate, possible. It would be funny if the Senate ends up being sort of, you know, left because of this redistricting, the House becomes more of a headache and the Senate starts to go fall into place. I think that's overstating it, obviously. But
well, J. Mart wrote in Politico about worries about backlash. And I don't know. I think maybe I'm too beaten down by the last 10 years to be hopeful about that. But the point that he was making is that Republicans did make a lot of ground with black voters, not really with black women, but with black men. Trump was the high watermark in a couple decades for Republicans, and just the overt effort to like overturn the progress made of the civil rights era and to take away voting power from black folks, I think could help on margins and on engagement turnout. And that could make a difference in some of these states. Again, will that make up for the rigging and the cheating? I don't know, but like it could matter in some of these districts, and I hope it's true. And people should be outraged and motivated rather than dispirited, because I do think that while the House seems tougher today than it did when we taped on Friday, the Democrats are still favored to take it. So,
ICE and Border Patrol have infuriated Latino voters quite justifiably. Yeah. It should have infuriated all of us, and now the court ruling should infuriate, and the subsequent state legislative action, which is so aggressive and out beyond the pale, should infuriate black voters. So, you know, Trump doesn't win without better numbers. They're not huge among blacks. They're pretty big among Latinos.
Yeah.
It doesn't win in 2024. They don't win the House, the Republicans, without that spillover from Trump. So it does matter if there's a real reaction, leaving aside like maybe some decent white people might be offended by this too, you know.
God willing. I'm a little dispirited about the hope for decent people coming to the defense of others, you know, but maybe it will happen. And they should be fucking righteously pissed and hoping to make a difference this November. And maybe that will, you know, also come in concert with some MAGA voters feeling not that motivated to turn out. So I do think that's the caveat here. But boy, it's enraging, right? and pretty negative development. Let's get to the fun. Here's some other things that could cut against the Republicans. Just their total lack on focus about the concerns of the American people of all races and genders and ages. The Secretary of Transportation, Sean Duffy, not like that important of a role. Secretary of Transportation, usually not at the center of our public debate, but in a moment where everybody is pissed off about gas prices, pissed off about the rising price of air travel, you'd think that he would be laser focused on trying to alleviate those concerns. Instead, he was on Fox and Friends on Friday announcing this.
So I wanted to lean into America's 250th birthday. Rachel and I actually met on a road trip on a reality TV show.
Right.
And so over the course of 7 months, we just kind of found these moments where I might be able to do some work. I could take the kids with me, do a road trip.
Oh, yeah.
And our motto is to love America is to see America. And there's so much to see in this beautiful country.
A 7 month road trip for the Secretary of Transportation? We're paying his salary. He's going to do some work. He's going to do some work. Well, he's on a 7 month road trip. Well, everybody is enraged about skyrocketing gas prices. To call that tone deaf feels like an understatement.
I couldn't agree more. They're so self-centered and smug and self-satisfied. Such jackasses. They don't see how this stuff looks. I hope it looks bad, and I hope people take advantage of it, honestly. I mean, Democrats should create fake road trips and have like little, I don't know what they should, I'm not good at this kind of thing, but some of our friends would be good at figuring out putting little, you know, mock-ups of Duffy and his family in some car and having them go around everywhere, you know, not doing his job. And isn't it paid for? Was it paid for by various corporations who put the money into some 501c3?
Yeah, it's paid for by a nonprofit run by a transportation industry lobbyist and funded by various transportation companies that are seeking Duffy's favor, things like Brightline, the private railway, and I think Toyota was in there. It's like, what? The swamp is buying off Sean Duffy so he can take his family to go see Mount Rushmore and the Arch and the Grand Canyon?
To see America. To love America. Like, to see America, Tim. You know, I mean, really, you're just
that.
Anti-American. You're typical anti-American lefty bulwark type, you know?
People aren't going to be able to go on road trips this summer because they can't fucking afford it, Sean Duffy. Like, what are you doing?
Cleverer people than I should think of ways to bring this home. Yeah, as plane ticket prices soar because of the price of jet fuel and as gas prices soar. I absolutely got to really make Sean Duffy more famous. They're really bad. You know, the Trump, maybe you haven't noticed this, the Trump cabinet is really bad. They're not just incompetent.
Pretty bad.
They're just smug assholes, if I could say so, you know?
Yeah, it's true. You know, Sam and I a couple weeks ago did our cabinet ranking, worst cabinet officials, and it's tough. I mean, it's competitive. It's really tough choosing. You know, having to narrow it down to the worst four was a challenge.
Is one of them, two of them respectable, do you think?
We always keep coming back to Doug Burgum as the respectable one.
Yeah, he's
Doug. But that said, there are some stories about some pretty strange ways which he's treating his staff. So I don't know. It's really one of the worst collections of individuals you could possibly imagine. Speaking of which, why don't we get into the comedy? One of the other ones, this is macabre, dark comedy, I guess, was our Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. We have the Hanta virus going around, you know, pretty serious. This the people on the ships, for some reason, we're bringing one person that was exposed to Hanta virus on one of these cruise ships back to America to quarantine. I'm kind of like, Can't we quarantine that person somewhere else? Do they have to be quarantined here? And there are some concerns that Robert F. Kennedy is in charge of that, you know, given his past comments and beliefs about how to deal with these kinds of pandemics and epidemics. John Mulaney, the comedian who did the famous "Trump is the horse in the hospital" bit, which is really good. He had a comedy show at the Hollywood Bowl this weekend, and some of the video leaked of that. And it's so good, I just want to play it for you.
Back when I lived in New York, he was in charge of a thing called the River Keepers. They were in charge of keeping the Hudson River clean. That was his job. That's how good he is at jobs. His old job was keeping the Hudson River, whose native fish is tied off used condom, clean. Now I'm in charge of your bones and your tummy. Stupid fuck. Your thing can't be the measles. Did you get the measles? Did you read the card it was from me? Do you like having the measles very much?
So that leaves me pretty concerned about the hantavirus, I guess. I don't know. You have any thoughts?
Yeah, no, not a. I think I'm staying off cruise. I was going to stay off cruise ships anyway for the next N years,
maybe
forever. Yeah, that's the easier way to say that. I think I'll just stick with that resolution. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not going to go on the MAGA gay cruise. We had a lot of
What is going on with that? Have you looked into that more closely?
No,
more closely
than that.
That's your kind of.
Yeah. I have an update. There was a cruise of gay MAGA influencers for people who don't follow, who are just pod only. We do a series of videos with Will Sommer and me and Sam Stein, trio videos, where we talk about the craziest stuff happening in MAGA over on the Bulwark Takes feed. And we did one on this. And I didn't really know a whole lot about it. I'd seen a MAGA gay that I follow had posted about his time there. And so we kind of, we watched that video and made fun of him and riffed on that. But after we published, a listener posted on the Bulwark Reddit page that they were on the ship, that they hadn't like rented out a ship for the MAGA gay cruise. Like when you did the Weekly Standard cruises, I assume it was all Weekly Standard people. No.
So at times you would get 250 cabins on a 1,000 cabin ship.
So I did not realize.
And you would eat together and you would have your own seminars and stuff and your own, you know, you'd get the ballroom. But no.
So I did not realize that. And so in this case, that cruise was about a third. And then this person was posting the pictures of them, like all of the gays in their red shirts, like over on the corner of the boat. And they weren't the cute gays. We should at least say that. But I can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine going on a cruise vacation in any circumstance, but talk about the bad luck. And I guess if you had to rank worst luck of getting on cruises, getting on the hantavirus cruise would be definitely number one, you know, since your life is at risk. The poop cruise, I think, number two would be the second worst. But then getting on a cruise and having it be the game, that has to be number three.
Nice three generation family from, you know, Wichita, Kansas. You know, I think this is going to be the 75th birthday of the grandparent. You know, this is how a lot of these crazy things, right? The teenage kids, the nice the in between the parents your age, and then it's showing up.
You're
and
on the pool deck, and it's a guy in a Hillary for prison speedo. You're like, what? I want to go with the your newsletter this morning was about, I told you there'd be laughs. The newsletter this morning was about the gold statue. Because we have the policy of not playing Trump's voice, I'm not going to play the audio. But there was a dedication of a golden calf at Mar-a-Lago. I don't know any other way to say it. It looks just like Kim Jong-un's golden statue. It looks just like the calf from the Old Testament. That's more of your area than mine, the Old Testament. Maybe you have some ruminations on that. Trump calls in to the dedication, talks about how great it is, how excited he is. He talks about how he went to the golf course. People were complimenting him about the golden statue. Pastor Mark Burns, who was the pastor, I guess, in charge of the statue, posted this. Today at Trump National Doral, history was made. I'm deeply honored to lead the dedication event for President Donald J. Trump and the unveiling of the 22-foot statue created in his honor. This was far more than a ribbon cutting. It was a moment for gratitude, honor, and remembrance. Let me say this plainly. This is not a golden calf. The statue is not about worship. It is about honor. So, I don't know. Doth protest too much a little bit, maybe. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think, let me say this plainly, this is not a golden calf. It's like not a good thing you ought to have to say about something. If you're a pastor blessing and consecrating this wonderful, grotesque, pretty ugly.
Why was it a pastor if we're not worshiping it? Shouldn't it have been a layman? I don't know if the clergy was necessary.
Yeah, they could put up the idiotic statue. It's his own golf course, I guess. It's private property. None of the rest of us has to see it anymore after this one video. Much well-deserved ridicule for Pastor Burns. A lot of people rallying to his defense. That guy Jeffries, who's like an anti gay, anti-Semitic, racist, anti-Catholic, pastor, I guess. Is your policy that we don't call them pastors if we don't? I mean, I'm open to that.
Pastor Doug, I didn't want to call a pastor, Pastor Doug Wilson, because he doesn't seem to even do any pastoring. Right. I his entire persona is just that he's a pastor that like wants to bring slavery back. So Jeffress, I remember him being very bad. There's a big controversy around McCain.
Yeah, terrible.
McCain said he didn't want to
campaign with
him. But he
does have a church, I think. I mean,
I don't know. So, yeah. I'm on the fence. I'm okay with if we're just calling him Robert.
Okay, anyway, pastor, yes. The pastor doth protest too much about it. It's not a golden calf. You know, everyone immediately sees it and thinks this quote consecration, and everyone immediately thinks golden calf. So the first words out of his mouth are, it's not a golden calf. But don't even think about that. You know?
It's raising some additional questions. I could have made it silver, could have made it orange. Trump's orange, that would have been an option. Purple.
Trump tweeted that it's like, it's the real deal. It's gold. It's, of course, like 1/8 inch, as I said, 1/16 inch gold leaf, whatever. It's ghastly. And but at least I make this point in the newsletter, it's not as stupid. Golf people signed up for Trump Doral have to endure it, I suppose. I think the world leaders, isn't the G20 meeting there at the end of this year? They have to walk by it. How humiliating. I mean, really,
you're the leader of a semi-serious
country and you have to walk by this 22-foot grotesque gold statue of Trump, which he's put up. I mean, allegedly donors have put up at his club, you know, and he's thrilled about it. He's thrilled when he called in that people are taking pictures of it of themselves with it. On the other hand, it's not good for Trump politically. It brings home even more. It's all he cares about is himself. And then, of course, I do think the arch here in Washington, which would intrude on Arlington Cemetery. So that's not something that's one of our most sacred public spaces. That's a different matter than putting up some idiotic statue to yourself at your private club. And the ballroom he wants $1 billion for. Democrats really need to go crazy about that stuff. I'm worried they're like being a little too, you know, we got to focus on affordability, Tim. And it's the kitchen table and the gas prices,
which
is important.
It's
all the same. But he is, I mean, the solipsism, the narcissism, the focus on this, couldn't care less about the gas prices. Sean Duffy doesn't care about it. None of them cares about them. That guy Wright, the energy secretary, maybe he does a little better job pretending to at least be concerned about them. I don't know, but they're not. It's pathetic, really. None of them cares about what actual people are going through. And I say this in the newsletter, I think you and I discussed this maybe shortly after 2016. When Trump said in 2016, Hillary says, wants you to say, I'm for her, but I say, I'm with you. I'm with her. I'm with you. Right?
That was, I'm with her. I'm with her.
That was their proud slogan, your first woman president. And I say, I'm with you. And I remember thinking when I heard that first, I think in some speech in New York, but then at the convention in Cleveland, thinking, that's a pretty effective line, you know? And he's done. And then of course with Kamala, it was the same thing. I'm with you. That I'm with you thing is gone. And people need to just hammer home that he's from only could care less. He's a narcissist who cares only about himself. And the ballroom, the statue, the arch are pretty good concrete examples of it that people can understand, I think.
Amen. I think it's a big political opportunity. It does make you a little sick to your stomach. I didn't really consider the Doral part. I mean, just the fact that the G7 is at Doral is a total insane affront. Thinking about Matt Iglesias post about this weekend, it's just, I got mad all over again about the coverage of Hillary's email server from 2016. He posted an analysis of it, and it was like, the three major nightly news spent like 4x more time on her email server than all policy issues combined. And it's like, they don't even cover this stuff anymore. What server is Jared Kushner talking to BB and MBS on? I don't think a public server that we can get access to, you know, and like the whole thing is absurd. And, you know, so there's not even the commensurate level of outrage at all about the fact that the G7 is at Doral. But then on top of that, to have to have like Friedrich Merz walking by like the Trump golden calf when he comes to the G7, it's like fucking ridiculous. It's crazy. It's sickening and hopefully politically useful, but sickening. And I was thinking about that in the context when we were in the green room discussing, we have our Bulwark confab in DC on Wednesday. And so pod might be out at a weird time on Wednesday, FYI on that. We'll have a full announcement for you guys tomorrow on how we're going to do it. But I'm like, I don't want to have to go by the buildings that have his face on it. I don't know how y'all live there, to be honest. Like, that makes me kind of sick, just like thinking about it, about how gross it all is. And that's of a piece with the calf, too. So I don't want to end us on a down note. So we're gonna. There was the Netflix was a joke thing last night. I didn't really have an angle for like a deep political analysis angle for this Chelsea Handler joke. It just was very satisfying. So Bill, why don't I say goodbye to you, and then we can just leave people with a little. We can just listen to Chelsea Handler together and laugh. How does that sound?
I'm for that. It's all right. Good being with you.
Good being with you. I'll see you. In DC.
Now we'll listen to the joke. We'll laugh, and I'll see you tomorrow, right?
In DC. Yeah, we'll see you tomorrow. Now we'll see you on Wednesday in DC. Everybody else, we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of the podcast. Here's Chelsea.
Now that your favorite leader is making the draft mandatory, I assume that all of you will be signing up to go fight in Iran. Or do you tough-talking pussies only go to the Middle East for comedy festivals?
I'm so happy we can say pussy again. Bye, everybody. See you tomorrow. Another loser's not in bed. By the Hudson River, the golden plate is getting ahead. Use condoms, float on the river's edge. She's head. Wouldn't it be lovely? The Borg Podcast is brought to you thanks to the work of lead producer Katie Cooper, associate producer Ansley Skipper, and with video editing by Katie Lutz, and audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.